We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Hi there, hockey fans, and welcome back to RotoWire's signature NHL Hockey Pod podcast with Statsman and AJ. Friends, I'm Paul Bruno in Toronto, Ontario, and you can follow me at Statsman22. My co-host, as always, is AJ Scholes, a great follow at AJ Scholes 24, based in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, near RotoWire headquarters over in Madison. On today's show, we're back to review the 8 first-round series that completed as of last night, and we'll preview the second-round sets, which some of them have already gotten underway, partner. And your impressions of that first round overall, I guess, are in order.
Well, you know, we saw it's been something that I think we've seen in past seasons, and this year was no different. Winning the division doesn't do you a whole lot of good in some cases. That was the case for my Penguins, for your Leafs. And so that bites you in the butt sometime. As I've brought up on this show before, Evgeny Malkin famously quoted as saying back when the Caps would win the division all the time, he would always say, "Caps win division, we win cup." And that seems to be a continuing trend. You know, we'll see if Colorado can maybe, or Carolina can upset that trend. But it certainly hasn't been a good thing to win your division lately, or even the President's Trophy that often.
Well, and you're echoing the fact that our first-round choices, there were some upsets, and my record was 5-3, yours was 4-4, though you did have two perfect picks overall, and I only had one, so we'll call that a wash between you and me. But we want to break down the series that went down in the first round before we go to the second-round sets, and let's start with a team that was one of the better teams and the better surprise teams in the regular season. That's the Carolina Hurricanes winning over Nashville. AJ, this was a set that went a little longer than both you and I thought. We did have the right winners, though, and the last four games wound up in overtime. Your overall impressions of this set?
Well, I think, you know, more than any other series, I think this one really showed what a home ice advantage can do right now when you get some fans in those buildings. Bridgestone Arena was absolutely bumping, and that helped Nashville to extend this bad boy to six games there. So, you know, for anybody that wants to talk about home ice advantage not, you know, really doing much, I think you need to consider that, you know, we've gone from no fans in many of these arenas to 25%, then quickly to 50, in some cases full capacity. And I think the players are getting more out of it than we've been maybe led to believe necessarily. And that, you know, it could be a game changer, especially, I mean, I'll be blunt about it. You know, Canadian teams still haven't really had much. I know they had the vaccinated healthcare workers for game seven for the Leafs last night. If there's not fans in those arenas, it could certainly be a huge factor for them not getting a home ice bump once we get to future rounds.
Absolutely, AJ. And in terms of the guys that showed up for Nashville, I'm surprised that we would mention the two centermen that we maligned much of the season. Ryan Johansson had three goals for them and one assist, and Matt Duchene, a goal and two helpers. They were not guys that we thought much of in terms of their play during the regular season, but credit for them, each of them, to showing up in this series. And then you got the defensemen that were certainly a key to their success all season long, Roman Josi and Ryan Ellis, doing their thing with 4 and 5 points respectively. The Canes, it was expected that their offense would be led by the usual suspects, and no surprise, Sebastian Aho was at the top of the list. Martin Netzkash had a nice series, but Jordan Staal was a real key surprise contributor. You knew he was going to play a shutdown role against the top offensive pieces of Nashville, but he also chipped in with 4 goals and 1 assist, so kudos to him for an outstanding series. Brett Pesce, emerging for me, one of the secrets in the NHL in terms of quality defensemen, had a 4-point set, and as well as playing stout defense. If he was playing in a major market, AJ, they'd be talking about this guy as one of the very best defensemen in hockey. That's the secret, that the extent to which I think he's been a secret thus far in his career. So what about the Florida, the Sunshine State set, AJ? It was a 6-gamer. We both thought it would be, this is one that you got right on, I thought it'd be a 7-gamer, but no surprise that it went almost the distance. Only one overtime game in this set. The high scoring was there as we expected. There was one shutout in the series in favor of Tampa. No surprise that Vasilevsky would rise up and take one of those. We expect him to be the best goalie in the playoffs as he was in the regular season. Again, I'll go to you and get your impressions on this matchup. What were the surprises? What were the expectations? And who delivered? Who didn't?
Well, I think the biggest thing, you know, from the Florida side of it is they got decent numbers out of the guys you would want. You know, Huberto had 10 points. Barkov had 7 points. Yeah, one goal, but putting up assists, being a playmaker there for them. If you want to get nitpicky, maybe you could point out the fact that they were a little power play dependent. Jonathan Huberto had 5 of his 10 points with the man advantage. Barkov had 4 of his 6. They got decent numbers out of Sam Bennett coming in at the trade deadline. So I really don't think they can be disappointed about that acquisition. I think obviously the biggest surprise was the netminding for them and the fact that they went with Spencer Knight here, had some decent outings for him. And I think it raises a lot of questions for what is going to happen next year. You know, Bobrovsky's making $10 million a year. You're not paying a guy that to be the backup. So do they try and trade him? Do they leave him exposed to Seattle? I think that would be crazy thing to potentially happen, but maybe they look that way. There's a lot more questions than answers, I think, for Florida next year. Tampa is more of the same. It's exactly what we thought we'd get from last year. The guys that are supposed to produce did, including, Vasilevsky and Kucherov coming in the postseason. And so this is a buzzsaw team that's going to try and take it all the way again.
I got to say, you mentioned the Florida goaltending situation. I did not like the call of pivoting away from Bobrovsky. You mentioned the big ticket that he is. He's their guy. He's their guy on the books for several years. And so why pivot away from him from one or two lousy results? You paid the guy. You've got to stick with him. They just created a hornet's nest of questions to their goaltending situation that could easily have been avoided and left as speculation to say, we have these two guys in reserve. Why did we go with this guy the whole way? The answer is because he's paid the big bucks. You have to go with him the whole way. Now they've got a three-headed monster in net. They're probably going to lose Dreger. I think he's gone in the offseason. Unless they deal him ahead of the expansion draft, AJ, I think the smart play would be to trade him in that space to another team rather than lose him outright to the expansion draft for nothing. I think he's an asset that that's a credible backup goalie at worst. And maybe there's other teams that would have seen enough in him, as I have, to think that he would even, could even contend for a number one role. Heck, I think the Leafs should take a look at this guy, and wouldn't he be a nice partner for Jack Campbell in a nice dynamic duo in Toronto? So I hope the Leafs come calling for a guy like Chris Driedger. Spencer Knight has all the tools, it looks like, to be their future goalie. But the man of the present should have been Bobrovsky, and I think it's a colossal blunder, and it opened up that cornet's nest that I described. And I think the Florida management team is going to have to deal with that all summer long as a major headache that could have been avoided. They also gave a very good account of themselves in the series, as you suggested. Their big guns did respond. Even a guy like Patrick Hornquist, you saw this guy up close, AJ. He was a buzzsaw in this set, got involved physically, and the pesky nature of his game highlights what you need in the postseason. A guy who's willing to get his nose dirty, he did that, and he also picked up 5 points along the way. So another guy worth highlighting. We were on Carter Verhaeghe early in the season as a question mark. He had a great regular season, and he had a decent playoff as well. He was a minus three, but he did have 3 points in the 6 games, so I think you can consider him part of the offensive core going forward. Their defense is sound. They certainly missed Aaron Ekblad, though, in the postseason. Wouldn't have been nice to see him in this matchup as well. You did a nice job covering the Tampa Bay team. Their stars did come out to play. Kucherov had an outstanding playoff round, considering he didn't play all the regular season. Nice to have a guy come out of reserve like that. I suppose it's a luxury that all the other teams envy at this stage, for sure. And Anthony Cirelli continued to show me why he's such a valuable part of this team. AJ picked up 4 points, continues to be very, very dependable defensively, one of the best two-way centers in hockey for my money, so I wanted to highlight him as well. And then Andre Palat, who is sitting in the wings there, always gets to play with the big boys, and he chipped in with 3 points. I think he's a very good DFS play. Low-end price point for him and Alex Killorn that I always take a peek at when those guys are on deck. So a lot of thoughts about that series for me come top of mind. Now, one that kind of stings you a little bit, AJ. We both were on the Penguins to win this series rather handily against the Islanders, but we both were wary of the strong defense and the tough checking that they would bring to the table, and they won out over your boys. So I'll give you a chance to chime in on what your observations were there, because you saw it much more closely than I did.
Well, I mean, for starters, you've got, the Islanders completely shut down the Penguins' first line. Sidney Crosby had just 2 points. Brian Rust had 3. Jake Gensel had just 2. You know, it wasn't, Malkin wasn't 100%. He missed the first 2 games, but he played in 4 games, had 5 points. You can't complain about that at all. Jeff Carter continued to be phenomenal for them. 4 goals in the 6 games. Even Chris Letang chipping in with 6 points in 6 games as well, leading the way. So, you know, really it was the lack of that first line, and it really disappeared. Even, a guy like Jason Zucker was maligned for much of the year for not producing at the level that he's supposed to. He gets 2 goals, 1 assist. Like, he's right up there with the rest of the guys, so better than nothing. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is Tristan Jarry completely just blew up and showed nothing, on top of the fact of the game 5 mistake. I mean, we'll leave it at that. But the rest of his performance was subpar. 0.888 was the save percentage, 3.18 goals against average. And honestly, I think if Casey DeSmith had been healthy, I think there's a chance we probably would have seen him at some point in this series, especially in that game 5. I think, you're coming off Islanders put up 4, win game 4-1. And I think that game 5 might have been a good opportunity to see Casey DeSmith. For their part, everybody wants to talk about the Islanders defensively, and that is their identity. That is their structure. And they got phenomenal net mining out of Ilya Sorokin. But the fact of the matter is they have an offense, and it's not the group you expect it to be necessarily. Matthew Barzal still hasn't scored a goal in the postseason here, but that second line, Josh Bailey, Brock Nelson and Anthony Bolivier has led the way for them and really produced at a high level. They get opportunities on the power play as well. So this is a group not to sleep on. I don't like the first line. I don't touch it right now in terms of DFS, but that second group I've used all postseason, Josh Bailey especially, because his price tag just hasn't adjusted for the most part. So a little bit of a DFS tip of the cap there for future weeks. They're not playing tonight, obviously, but the Islanders have more offense than people give them credit for.
And it was pretty well spread out as well. You mentioned Beauvillier with 9 points in 8 games so far in this postseason, their leader, unexpected as he is. And Barzal, on the other hand, looking for his first goal in 8 games, only has 4 assists to show for his record. Brock Nelson, to me, is an underrated player as a number 2 center here, AJ. He's a shoot-first center I call him Austin Matthews light, because he's in that same mold as a guy who's more noted
for. I mean, we can get to that in a little bit, but maybe he's Austin Matthews heavy based on what we saw in the postseason.
Nice shot. So anyway, I'm curious to ask you about the Pittsburgh side. You mentioned in a couple of tweets, do you think this is actually the end for the core group here? We'll talk about the core group in Toronto when we get to that team too. But for Crosby and Malkin, they are well-decorated players in this league, along as with Chris Letang in the defense corps. That trio has had a lot of playoff success, and they have the cup rings to show for it. But are we seeing the end of that, let's call it a dynasty run for those three guys?
I think we are, to be totally honest with you. You know, let's not forget we have a new GM, new president of hockey operations in there. So I think the biggest piece, and I don't know what his value is. Maybe they won't be able to, but I think Chris Letang is a serious option to be traded. He does have a limited, no trade clause, but there's 18 teams that he can be traded to. That gives the Penguins plenty of leverage. You'd be bringing him on for just the last year of a deal, so it's manageable from that side for another team. So that, I think, is potentially piece one, is that you trade away Chris Letang in that $7.2 million cap hit. I don't want the next thing I'm going to mention to happen. I think he deserves better than this. I think he should have been a Jack Adams Award winner multiple times, but I do wonder if they're going to bring in a new coach and get rid of Mike Sullivan. That's 4 straight first-round postseason exits for them since winning the Cups in back-to-back years there. I love Mike Sullivan. I think he's a great coach. They should keep him, in my opinion, but I don't know that that's going to happen again. You have new new front of house, and this is on top of the fact that they already forced him to change all of his assistants last year. By all accounts, last year he didn't want to change his assistants. They made him get some new people in there anyway. So it could be the end of the Mike Sullivan era as well. And I will say, Paul, as I said on those tweets, I'll mention here as well, for the first time ever, I do think the window is for sure closing, if not already closed, on this group. Maybe if they, wiggle some cap room, get some other guys in here, maybe Crosby and Malkin can make one more run at it. But if they keep all three together with how much they're paying Chris Letang on there, I just don't see it.
Okay, we'll jump to the next series that where we differed in opinion, and I got this one right. You had Washington winning in 7. I had Boston in 6. Boston, in fact, made very short work of the Washington Capitals in a 5-game set, and it was close for a couple of games, but the 4th game was the swing one, where Boston won by a 3-goal margin, and they carried the day with a 3-1 win to wrap it up. They were relatively low-scoring games, which we expected, AJ, so I don't know that there were too many surprises other than the fact that it was a rather short set. Your observations on this matchup?
Well, I think, you have to point out the fact that Evgeny Kuznetsov missed a couple of games here. You also had Ilya Samsonov wasn't available for them for a couple of games as well, and I think you can't undersell the impact that had. Lars Eller missed time. So, I don't want to make excuses. They had plenty of talent still left on the ice. But, look, Craig Anderson appeared in 2 games for the Washington Capitals. 1 start, 1 in relief. And I don't think that's their recipe for success heading into this postseason. Samsonov, for his part, lost all 3 of his outings. And maybe that's, maybe that's part of the problem, coming back from having tested positive for COVID. Maybe he just wasn't fully up to snuff. You would have liked to see a little bit more out of deadline acquisition Anthony Mantha. 2 assists in 5 games is fine, but you certainly want a little bit more from him. But they were very stretched at center when you consider that Kuznetsov Ehler missed some games here.
You know what? And that speaks to a problem that was apparent during the late part of the regular season, where there were some disciplinary issues with these guys. A couple of players got in trouble with the COVID protocol a couple of times, and Kuznetsov was on that list, as well as Samsonov. So I've heard little whispers that Kuznetsov is a guy whose name is out there in trade talks, AJ, and maybe the core of the Washington Capitals is another one where we can expect some significant change, because moving him would be a very significant move. He's younger than Backstrom at center, and a guy I thought that would be a scoring line player for this team for years and years. But I think the runway got a lot shorter with the nonsense that the headlines that he was involved with in terms of the COVID violations and so on. And that was a big distraction that this team did not need. They were also hampered by the fact that their starting goalie was similarly in affected. And against a team like Boston, where you know their top players show up every single night, that you can't afford any slip-ups like that. And to me, that was why I had Boston in the series from the outset, AJ. And it played out to a T from what I expected. And the next set, AJ, that we're going to look at is the one that pains me the most, and that's the Maple Leafs and the Montreal Canadiens. I'll try and keep my comments short because I could go on and on about this. We just did a hit with DraftKings where I was allowed to go on, and I thank them for that opportunity. But I just think the Maple Leafs core, it's a young group, AJ. And last night I thought they got to blow it up. They got to get rid of somebody. From that group, they are the only team in the league that has four guys costing the club $40 million under the cap. That's got to change, ideally. But if you believe, as some people do, they've only been the favorite of one of their first-round exits in the last 5 years. So some people think they deserve a mulligan and let this group have another run. I'm undecided about that, the way I feel right now. They were hampered big time by the 10 minutes into the first game. They lose their captain to an awful injury, and that kind of caused them to punt that game, and it was obviously a pivotal loss because they were able to bounce back and win the next three games, and I thought they were home and cooled out. Then they dropped two games in overtime, and then last night that was a no-show for another 45 minutes. The last three games, they took so long to get on track that Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, in a nutshell, did not perform in this series. 1 point between them over the entire seven-game set. So Willie Nylander at least did his part with five goals, including the meaningless marker at the end of the game that prevented Carey Price from walking away with a Game 7 shutout. But Montreal really clogged up the front of their net, and they checked the Leafs into the ice, and that was the difference in the series, where Philippe Deneau did an outstanding job nullifying Austin Matthews. That's a $3 million player, shutting out an $11 million player, and that was a key aspect in the series. Carey Price, while he was great, he was not super great or outstanding, or the ultimate difference maker for me. It was the checking line against Matthews and that group that carried the day for the Canadiens, and at the end of the day, they were deserving winners.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think for me, you know, I have to look at the head of the operations here in Kyle Dubas. And I think you look at some of the deals that he made heading into the offseason or into the trade deadline here. Fifth round pick for Ben Hutton. Yeah, an injury, but that didn't really help you much. Third round pick for David Rittich. That didn't help you at all. He didn't make any appearances in the postseason. The first rounder and two fourth rounders for Nick Foligno. I think he had, 1 point in four games. He didn't even play all the games there. Riley Nash, a conditional six-round pick. Again, you know, we're talking six-round pick. It's a coin toss, but, you know, Riley Nash didn't do really anything. in fact, he didn't. He only played in two games. He didn't have any points in those two games. So, I mean, these moves that were supposed to help kind of bolster things and give you more depth just showed that the center depth was never addressed. And I think that was the plan with Nick Foligno, and it didn't work at all. Because as soon as Tavares went down, then it was like, well, we'll just focus on the top line and do our best against those guys, and we'll go from there. So really, you know, some credit to the Habs, right? Like, that we got to talk a little bit about them. Carey Price was at his absolute best. I know, Paul, you've taken some shots across the bow at Carey Price in the past, and not undeservedly so, but I think in this one he is the key piece here that got them across the goal line in winning this series and really taking them on to the next round.
AJ, I'll put the question to you then specifically. Do you give this core group of the Leafs, the four guys at $40 million bucks, the management team, another crack going at it with that group intact? Or do you move, say, a Marner or a Nylander before next season begins?
I mean, they've just got so many UFAs that they need to make other decisions on that, you know, the $10 million or almost $11 million you could get, you know, if you traded Mitch Marner, could really help, you know, or maybe you try and trade Tavares. I think you'd have riots in the street if you did that one. But, you know, they've got to make some decisions here. Some of these are depth veterans who are a little bit older, but Riley Nash, Zach Hyman, Wayne Simmonds, Nick Foligno, Alex Galchenyuk, Jason Spezza, Joe Thornton, like, We talk about the Leafs being a young team. These are some veteran guys that aren't young by any stretch of the imagination. But they're going to need new deals if they want to bring any of these guys back. You know, any other playing that they want to do in free agency, they could really use the space. And so, you know, trading one of those guys might not be the worst idea if you can get some sort of value. Are you ever going to get enough to make the Toronto media happy? Probably not. But you can at least try and do your best there.
Yeah, I think of the names that you mentioned, the only guy that I want to see back is Jason Spezza. That guy played heart and soul on display every night, and he deserved more ice time than he got, quite frankly, playing several of the other top six forwards on this team. He wants to play for this city, and he wants to play for that flag, on a crest on his jersey. I got time for players like that. Others who claimed as much didn't show up. And they know who they are, and they shouldn't be invited back. That should be the barometer. And in terms of people that are coming in for replacing those players, they better have Stanley Cup success on their resume. Otherwise, Leaf fans shouldn't be interested, and neither should their management team. So that's my editorial comment on that to close the books on yet another disappointing season for the team that I love.
I'll trade you Marner for Letang. You can have Letang. He's got Stanley Cup pedigree. I'll take Mitch Marner.
If he comes in at $1 million and they can spend some more money elsewhere, I might think about that one. But
he's less than Marner.
That's true. Look, we got the other Canadian series to break down. That's Edmonton versus Winnipeg. We were both shocked at this outcome. We both had Edmonton winning it very quickly. Instead, it was Winnipeg that won it even quicker than we projected. Edmonton in five, and Winnipeg swept the Oilers. So if there's any team that feels worse, group of fans that feels worse than either the Pens or the Leafs fan group, it's got to be the Edmonton Oilers fans. What do you do if you're an Edmonton Oilers fan this morning? And how did you see this series eventually playing out?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you do if you're an Oilers fan right now. You've got two of the best players in the world. You should be able to win some games. I know I've maligned him in the past, but Mike Smith wasn't terrible. I mean, he wasn't great, but he wasn't terrible in this outing. We did both say heading into the offseason last year, we felt like they needed to address the goaltending situation and get somebody better in there. So I still don't think this is a poorly constructed roster. I think they've got pieces here. I just think what happened is Connor Hellebuyck turned back the clock and showed up in a way that we have not really seen this season, and was just outstanding. I mean, you're talking about 8 goals allowed on 159 shots, a .950 save percentage. Like, that dude just showed up and decided that they were winning this series pretty much. You know, they got offensively the boost from getting Nikolai Ehlers back. Pierre-Luc Dubois seems to have finally figured something out from that standpoint. He's been adjusting to being on the wing and kind of shuffled back between center and wing. I still don't think long-term that's the right plan for them. I think they're better off having, you know, three guys down the middle, but for now it's what they're going to roll with. So I put this less on Edmonton and more on Winnipeg, to be totally honest with you. Connor Hellebuyck just wasn't going to lose.
And the fact is that Winnipeg has a very big team, a physical team. And if Edmonton wasn't going to outskate them, they were going to run into them. And that would not have been a winning combination for them over the long haul. And it was a short haul because Hellebuyck did dialed back to his Vezina Trophy form, as you suggested, out-dueling Mike Smith, who performed heroically from my viewpoint. A 2.4 goals against average keeps you in every game, and he did his part at 39 years of age, though I think this could be viewed upon as almost a swan song for him. There's noise about him coming back for another year, and the management team does want him back, but they got to find a better partner than Koskinen, somebody that they can trust to be the next guy. Koskinen is not that answer. AJ, you and I both know it. Anybody who saw this team play all season knows it as well. The Oilers behind Draisaitl and McDavid, they were looking at the likes of Nugent Hopkins, Puljujärvi, Yamamoto to carry the mail. Those guys combined for 2 goals and 3 assists in the 4 games. You need better support scoring than that. Zach Cassian could have been a physical presence in this set, didn't receipt for any penalty minutes, and didn't play much of a physical role when I watched these games either. He could have been a bigger factor. So there's a lot of guys that could have looked in the mirror and said, could have impacted things much more. Darnell Nurse on defense, I think, is a stud here and a guy that they can build around that group. But there are talks about Tyson Barrie being shipped out, which I'm surprised to be hearing already, AJ. That's the biggest surprise that I've heard out of Edmonton's camp in the wake of this postseason. But he is very suspect defensively. He was only a +1, so not a glaring problem. But overall, I saw him for a year in Toronto, and the defensive side of the puck for him is an absolute rumor. And he was very much aided by the fact that he got a lot of ice time with McDavid and Draisaitl to pad his offensive numbers. But I think they saw enough of him to say, you know what, this might be a sell high opportunity on him. The Jets, for their part, their stars came out to play. Scheifele and Wheeler leading the attack with 5 points apiece, and Kyle Connor looking good with 4 points, but also Nick Ehlers back in the fold, played 2 games, got 2 goals. That guy is a dynamic player, AJ, that doesn't get a lot of play south of the border, and I think is a guy that they will key on in the next series, Montreal will, to try and limit him, because I think he is one of the drivers of that attack as much as anybody else that doesn't get talked about. And they have a very stout physical defense, too. And it'll be interesting to see how that group plays against Montreal and whether.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Craig doesn't have The Athletic. So now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
So they can slow down the pesky forwards of the Canadians on the forecheck, make them reluctant to get involved in the forecheck. We'll break that series down in a few minutes when we get to the second round sets. But you know what, partner? Let's take a moment to get a word from our sponsors. We'll be back with a look at the remaining first round series and break down that second round series that's gotten underway. You're listening to Puckcast with Satsman and AJ. We'll be back right after this. Okay, we're back on the podcast with Statsman and AJ, and we got 2 more series to break down. We're looking at the Western Division, AJ, of the league, where Colorado and Vegas won their respective series. One was much easier than the other, and we'll start with the easy one, and that was where you had it right on the button with a 4-game sweep by Colorado. I picked Colorado to win the series, but I thought it'd be more of a dogfight. And let me say this, it was based on the fact that I liked the pedigree of St. Louis as a recent Stanley Cup champion with some of its core still returning. And I thought that they would rely on that savvy to make this a competitive set. But they basically got steamrolled by Colorado, and you saw it coming from miles away. I give you tons of credit for this call.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, you add in the game one of the next series, but you're looking at Nathan MacKinnon with 8 goals and 4 helpers in 5 games, Gabriel Landeskog, 4 goals, 7 helpers, and Mikko Rantanen, 2 goals, 7 assists for his part. I mean, these guys have just been showing up every single night and putting up points on everybody. So that is an offensive team that is just cruising right now. And honestly, on the back end, you've got Philip Grubauer, who was just announced today as one of the finalists for the Vezina Trophy, 0.941 save percentage in the playoffs here. I mean, this guy, they've got an unbeatable netminder, offensive production coming out the wazoo from that top line, and they're even getting it from the back end. You've got, you look at their top 5 point producers, Cale Makar comes in at number 4 with 7 points. Ryan Graves comes in at number 5 with 5 points. And so these guys have just been outstanding. There's not really a huge weakness to this team. If there's one spot that I don't like, it's maybe their center depth with, you know, Nazem Kadri suspended for, you know, likely until game 7 of this series, and unless the neutral arbitrator makes a different decision there. But even that, like JT Confer, Tyson Yost have filled in okay. And when you have an unstoppable top line like this, the final that would be really interesting to watch would be the battle of the top lines, to see Colorado go up against Boston and just see what that would look like. But yeah, I mean, I totally expected them to steamroll them because they just don't have a lot of weaknesses. And the Blues all season long have just had somewhat suspect netminding from Binnington. And so you have powerhouse offense, already shaky netminder. It was a recipe for disaster. And that's why we saw the Avs put up 20 goals in 4 games here.
But AJ, I like I said, I was looking at the veteran guys on St. Louis who are recent cup winners. O'Reilly, 3 assists. Tarasenko, 2 points. Bozak, 2 points. Hoffman came up with 1 goal. Sammy Blais, 1 goal. Braden Schenn, 1 point. Colton Parayko, 1 assist, and then nobody else did anything. Jaden Schwartz was blanked. And so I expected much more from a lot of guys that play the two-way game very well in St. Louis, but they were steamrolled by Colorado. And again, I give you credit for that call. Outstanding work there, partner, on that one. The last series was one where it went the distance, and I called this one, so I give myself a little bit of a pat on the back. I thought Minnesota played very well in the last month and a half of the schedule, AJ, and I knew they would give this team a headache. You said also it would be a long series. You had them in 6, so we're both on the right side of this equation. But let's give a tip of the hat to the Minnesota Wild here for making it a very big challenge for Vegas and setting them up for that first game debacle loss against Colorado that we will talk about in a sec.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the thing that you have to like and be encouraged by if you're a fan of theirs, of the Wild, is that the guys that produce, now nobody had more than 3 points, which is a bit of a concern, but it's all spread out, which is also a benefit. So it's like depth versus star power, right? But Kaprizov gets 3 points. Joel Eriksson-Ek has 3. Jordan Greenway has 3. Like, these are some of the up-and-comers in your organization that are going to lead the way into the future. Kevin Fiala with two points, you know. So I guess it's a little bit of a give or take. They ground out some wins. Cam Talbot was another goaltender that kind of turned the clock back a little bit here. He had an outstanding series. But on the other side, I think the concern for me with Vegas is that, you know, for a couple games there, the offense really, you know, dried up. You have game 1, they didn't have any goals. You got game 6, they didn't have any goals, just 2 in game 5. So, but then they explode for 7 in game 7 or 6 in game 7, right? So like their offense is so streaky right now, that it's questionable. And look, I, Paul, you give me a hard time all the time for being the head of the Marc-Andre Fleury fan club. And while I am not a part of any official fan club, if there is one, I probably should join. But having said that, I know Fleury's last couple of games were a little shakier than they had been, but I will get into this later. But I can't believe they started Robin Leonard for game 1 of that series. And I'll be blunt, they got what they deserved.
Very, very interesting call. We'll get into that in a sec. But you mentioned Cam Talbot. He receded for a couple of outstanding performances in this set to win a couple of games. But Minnesota also outshot Vegas a couple of times and lost those games. They were that close to really winning this series outright, AJ. And Vegas has to think they almost escaped that first round rather than winning it, I think is the way I would frame it. They certainly have to be pleased that Max Pacioretty's back in the fold, and he hit the ice running with a strong performance in his first game back, and looks like he's ready to resume his role as a very, very key part of this team going forward, and they'll need him to be at his productive best to have a shot against the steamroller that is the Colorado Avalanche. But I have to say, I was a little alarmed by the up-and-down nature of the Vegas Knights. We know that they have the high-octane offense, but I think their defense hurt them a little bit, and their structure was not in place for all the games in that first series like we've seen it for much of the season, and that made it a tough workout for Marc-Andre Fleury, who was full value as maybe the key piece for that got Vegas through this set. It was a much tighter fit than anybody really should have envisioned when these teams lined up, but we saw it coming because Minnesota, as I said, did have that strong second half of their season and really, really scared the heck out of Vegas fans everywhere. All of this now, AJ, brings us to the fact that we only have 8 teams remaining, and it's time to go through the second round. And unfortunately for us, really to make a pure preview, we're partway through a couple of the series. In Boston and the Islanders, we've seen the team split 2 games. The Bruins, a decisive winner in Game 1 at home, but they were somewhat surprised in Game 2 with an overtime loss. And let's break down this series from the point of view of goalies, defense, and forwards, as we normally do. Can you take us through your observations of the goalie matchup in this set?
Well, the goalie situation has been very murky with the Islanders. You know, they got some really good, solid games out of Ilya Sorokin, but then he kind of gives up 4 goals, rather, in Game 1 against Boston. So then they went with Varlamov in Game 2, and, you know, that wasn't much better performance, you know, goaltending-wise from Varley. They did get the win, as you mentioned, but I'm a little surprised that they went with Varlamov. I would have thought Sorokin would have earned himself a little leeway when you consider he won 4 straight games against the Penguins, and basically, you know, he won the series for them. I was a little surprised to see that decision. Things have suddenly gotten a little murky on the other side, too, when you consider Tuukka Rask. You know, they announced today he's banged up, dealing with some injuries. Expected to be okay for Game 3, but at some point, do you maybe look Swayman's way if he just doesn't look right? This was, you know, his worst game of the postseason was this last one here. It gave up the most goals. It's the only game in the playoffs he's had a sub-900 save percentage. So I think it'll probably continue to be Rask as long as things don't get worse, but it's certainly something to keep an eye on. On the other side, I have no idea. I think what we can expect out of Barry Trotz to continue to tell us is that it'll be a left-handed Russian netminder. So we can feel pretty confident we're not going to see Corey Schneider. But from that, the rest of the way, those guys could be sharing some duties. I personally would go back to Sorokin for my money.
You know what? I think that's the prudent call, in my estimation, based on the first round that we saw. He definitely outperformed his partner and deserves the lion's share of the starts based on that matchup. I look at the depth charts on defense here, AJ, and it's plain to see that both teams are predicated on their respective groups on the blue line, but not really a lot of star power unless you highlight Charlie McAvoy for the Bees. And that might be the only reason that you give them a slight margin. But we've talked at length over the couple of years now about the shutdown unit that the Islanders feature at the top of their pairings, and that's Pelech and Pulock, Adam and Ryan, respectively, not known for offense. If you're looking for offense from this group, you might be limited to Nick Leddy, who's a second-pairing guy partnered with defensive-minded Scott Mayfield. Andy Green and Noah Dobson give you a nice look with a veteran and a youngster who has an upside there. Noah Dobson, I think his best days are ahead of him in terms of being an offensive contributor, but right now he's in a third-line role, kind of shielded from the... They try to keep him away from the top opposing forward line, so he shouldn't see too much of the perfection line in this series. Meanwhile, the Bruins, will trot out a bunch of, like a relatively no-name defense when you look at what they've been able to do in recent years. And it's notable that their two of their top guys in previous years are already out of the playoffs in Torrey Krug and Zdeno Chara. So that's left them with the likes of Matt Grzelcyk and Charlie McAvoy at the top pairing there. Mike Riley, an outstanding addition for me, AJ. He's shown an offensive flair that I didn't expect to see out of him. He's more noted as a rugged defensive type, but fits the Bruin mold. And boy, facing him and Brandon Carlo is a chore when you think about the defensive acumen of Carlo, a beast in the mode of the aforementioned Chara, as a big guy who can motor and is a murder to play against because of his physical play. Then you got the third pairing, Jeremy Lauzon and Connor Clifton, two guys that just kind of hold the fort. They're more defensive-minded than the offensive side of the puck. So there's not a lot of DFS value on either side of the coin here, AJ, but do you say anything different when you break down these pairs, which I think are almost identical in terms of quality and depth?
I mean, the one thing I would mention is Charlie McAvoy, I do think, has some offensive upside when you consider that all six of his assists have come with the man advantage. So that's kind of a nice little perk if you're going to stick him into your DFS lineups. Whether that's worth the price or not, that's a decision our listeners will have to make on a nightly basis here. But I do think you're right. Outside of that, there's not anybody that's going to put up with numbers with any sort of consistency. So that's certainly a concern. Among the forward ranks, look, I talked earlier about the fact that, the Islanders have a number of offensive pieces that are producing on that second group. And I think if they are going to get past Boston here, they need to find something with the first trio. Leo Komarov, not doing much. Matthew Barzal, I mentioned, doesn't have any goals yet. Jordan Eberle is contributing a little bit here. They've gotten good numbers out of Jean-Gabriel Pageau in that third center group. We talked about him all season long. He had 2 points in game two there. And so I think there's definitely some depth pieces. But when you want to talk about star power, obviously you're looking at Boston and that top line there, the perfection line. Those guys combining for 23 points in 7 games here. If there's a criticism, you could point to, maybe David Krejci doesn't have any goals, but he does have 5 helpers. Who's complaining about that? Taylor Hall continues to produce 3 goals, 1 assist in 7 games. So there's not a lot of concern. I guess my one, flag would be the fact that Craig Smith is dealing with an injury that kept him out of game 2. Jake DeBrusk, for his part, though, stepped in admirably in that one. Yeah, he didn't put any points on the board in that game, but 3 shots on goal, 3 hits. Like, I think that's a fine outing for him paired with those top guys, and I think the points will come there. So the more star power leans towards Boston, but both of these are relatively deep clubs. I guess I would favor the Islanders in depth personally.
I'm going to go on the other side of that ledger, AJ. I'm going to give a small check mark in favor of Boston. It is a slight edge, but it's also for me because of their second line. There's nobody on the Islanders that compares to the first line the Bruins can trot out there. Let's say that right away. And Matthew Barzal has underperformed in these playoffs, so I give a big check mark to the first line for Boston in most series, but double that because of the struggles of the Islanders' star center. It's the second line, so they're compelling viewing, AJ, in this series. The Taylor Hall's addition to the Boston Bruins has been a jumping off point for this team. In the season series, it was 5-3 for the Islanders. Interesting to note that Boston won the last 3 contests after the acquisition of Taylor Hall, and they added to that with the first game of the series, though the Islanders did rebound to win the overtime game, so they broke that streak a little bit. But David Krejci has to be thrilled because he's got now a primetime sniper on his wing. And Jake DeBrusk has had some nice runs in previous postseason, so he had a subpar year, motivated for better results in the postseason. So I like the fact that he's installed as a replacement for Smith as long as he struggles, but it's nice depth option for the Bruins. In terms of the bottom 6, Nick Ritchie Ritchie has played a lot of top 6 minutes for them on the season, and Charlie Coyle is a luxury for this team, AJ, I'll say that. As a third-line center, he would make it as a second-line center on a handful of teams in this league, I do think. There's a bit of a weak spot on the right flank with Smith out of the lineup. They have to promote a guy like Carson Kuhlman into the top nine forwards. And then after that, it's plug and play with guys like Corrali, Lazar, and Wagner in their fourth line. The Islanders, I can't say anything about the forward lines on the Islanders without a mention of their fourth line, the best fourth line in hockey. Casey Cizikas, Cal Clutterbuck, and Matt Martin, they get you in a mixer, and they bounce off everything on the ice whenever they're out there. So you got to have your head up when these guys are out there. And Kyle Palmieri's finally acclimatized himself to the Islanders situation. So I'll give them the edge in terms of third line here, because I really like this third line the Islanders trot out in Jacques-Gabriel Pageau and Zajac playing with Palmieri. And you mentioned it earlier, even in the DraftKings segment that we'll highlight on YouTube a little bit later on today, where we made an appearance. Anthony Beauvillier, Brock Nelson, and Josh Bailey have been carrying the mail for the Islanders in this postseason, and if they hope to extend the Bruins, this line will have to continue to play lights out and be the biggest factor as long as the Islanders' first line is not doing what they need to do. Which brings us to our series predictions. AJ, I've talked a lot. I need a break. So break down this series for me. Overall, what do you see playing out?
I think we're going to see a lot more of what we saw in game two. You know, the three-goal victory in game one, I think it's going to be an outlier for this series. I do ultimately expect Boston to take it. Maybe I'm underselling the Islanders a little bit. Maybe it's some sour grapes there, but I do think Boston is the better built team here. I do think it'll go the distance, and I'm expecting Boston to close it out in a game seven at home.
I am with you, except for I think they're going to do it on the road. I'm taking the Bruins in six. I just think that their offense, if the two lines are going, is going to be more than enough for the Islanders to handle. And I that's also predicated on the fact that I hope that Tuukka Rask is healthy and that he can play in this series. And if he does, that gives them an edge in goal. So I give them an edge in goal, an edge in offense. Let's call the defense a wash. And I come away with a Boston victory in six games in this set. Then a series that some people would hope would have been the Stanley Cup final in other times or a semifinal. We're getting this series a lot earlier in the playoffs than we otherwise would, AJ, and that's Colorado versus Vegas. The regular season series was tied at 4 each, and we saw game one, a game that we'll talk about right off the top for a little bit, because you said it best. You were surprised by the goalie choice for the Knights. They kind of sacrificed Robin Lehner, I'll say, throwing him to the Lions, a Colorado team that was waiting for the other series to play out. And Vegas had to go from the frying pan into the fire after playing Minnesota for seven games. They were fed to the wolves here as the Avalanche came out, and they threw an avalanche at Vegas in that first game. Your thoughts on the goalie call? Go ahead.
Well, I think one of our writers for RotoWire summed it up best in his headline on that game wrap there, calling it nightmarish playoff debut for Robin Lehner. Look, you get to play in your first game since, you know, before the postseason started. You were used to go. I mean, they literally, these guys went every other night from about late March all the way through the end of the season, really splitting the crease. You lose out on the games, and so you finally get your opportunity. And boy, was that not the way to secure yourself most postseason games. I would not be surprised if we don't see any more Robin Lehner the rest of the year after that one. Now, he did face a lot of shots. 37 is a lot of shots to face, certainly, but seven goals allowed, that's just brutal. And you know what? I think it was most telling was the fact that they left him in there, which speaks to me that they were more giving Fleury a night off. That's what it seems like to me. If the decision was that you were going to switch to Lehner and you know, maybe go back to a split or maybe give him a couple games and an opportunity here, you probably would have pulled him, I think, and put Flower out there, you know, after it got to four or five or something. So, I would expect we'll see Marc-Andre Fleury for game two. I will tell you this, we'll talk about our predictions in a little bit, but if we do see Robin Lehner for any more games, I'm going to cut down the number of games that this series is going to go, because it's not going to last long based on that performance. On the other side of the ice, we talked about Philip Grubauer, nominated for the Vezina Trophy. He came out and looked exactly as you would expect, and stymied an offense that's been streaky at best anyway. It'll all be Philip Grubauer. No goalie conflicts at all in Colorado. Exactly. They know who their starter is, and they knew who they're going to use the rest of the way.
And you know what? I can't disagree with anything that you did say. It was clear, though, that they were trying to buy Fleury some time and get him a rest. He's in his latter part of his career, obviously, late 30s in age, and he played a ton of high-leverage minutes against a Minnesota team that was relentless in a number of games in that series. And they effectively punted on that first game, but there were other casualties on the Vegas side of the ledger. We'll get to the forwards, where they're weakened a little bit at that level. But before we go there, let's highlight the defense. And you know what? Star power all over the place for Vegas. Alex Pietrangelo, Shea Theodore leading the parade as two top DFS plays night in, night out. But maybe a B-level version of that, the DFS value, you find it in Alec Martinez, who partners out with Alex Pietrangelo in a lot of those high leverage minutes as the top defensive pair. So that's where most of the DFS value is. It's a shame for them that Braden McNabb is out of the lineup, so that weakens the depth here a little bit and forces them to play Nicholas Haig and Zach Whitecloud a little bit more than you would otherwise expect, and maybe even Nick Holden to a certain extent. I think McNabb would even threaten for top 4 minutes in this pairing, this grouping, if he was healthy. So they're not going in with a full deck over there. Meanwhile, Colorado, you know what? They don't talk about Cale Makar as much as they should in the league press releases and the game summaries that I've seen. But in the last 30 games, he's been almost a point per game player there. Maybe it's a function of playing out in the West, but some players just they're in the clouds when people don't see their results as well as some of the guys on the East Coast or even Central. But Makar, one of the top values in DFS play, night in, night out for the high-octane offense that we've described. Devin Taves is his partner, so he's kind of a sneaky DFS value play. Even the second-pairing guys get involved in the offense quite regularly, and that's Samuel Girard and Ryan Graves. So four real good options for DFS play in this postseason, as long as Colorado is playing with that high-octane offense at full tilt. Guys that mind the storm more on the third pairing defensively first is Patrick Nemeth and Connor Timmins. Not too much DFS value there, but they complete a really nice-looking six-pack, and they have some depth with the likes of Bowen Byron sitting in reserve. So when you're going on hoping to go on a long playoff run, you need that depth, and I think Colorado has that in reserve as well. So how do you break down the defenses of both teams, AJ? There's a lot of star power in Vegas, the way I see it, and a good number of players that fit that bill on the other side as well.
Well, I love the Colorado blue line. I think it's phenomenal. One of the best things that they did recently was going out and getting Devin Taves. I mean, they've got a four-pack of guys who can legitimately contribute offensively. Makar, 7 points. Graves, 5. Taves and Girard, both of them picking up 3 helpers a piece there. And I think that's a stud group there that's really, maybe, as you said, a little under. Maybe the rest of us just don't want to show up, and watch games that late. But on the other side, you know, I mentioned 3 assists for some of those guys. That's great. 3 assists for Alex Pietrangelo. That's awful. Like, that guy should not be doing three assists. He needs to be producing closer to the Graves numbers. So the injuries are definitely a factor. Braden McNabb being hurt and missing some time is a factor. But I have loved Colorado's group all the time, and I expect them to continue rolling and producing the rest of the postseason.
Let's break down the forwards, AJ. We begin with a look at the Vegas side of things, where that first game took a bite out of their depth. When you consider Matthias Janmark, looked to me that he got pretty rocked on a hip in that game one, so a casualty, physical casualty, but then a brain fart by Ryan Reeves is going to cost him a couple of games, and that's a pivotal loss, I think, for Vegas. He brings a ton of physicality to his game, and let's face it, he instills fear in some opponents because he's the toughest dude in the league for my money, and so they'll miss him big time. And people should not sleep on the center of their first line. When you talk about sneaky good DFS value play, I begin and end with Vegas's Chandler Stephenson, who has had a very nice season in between Mark Stone and the recently returning to the lineup Max Pacioretty. That line is intact and rolling, ready to roll, rather, in the playoffs. And I think you got to consider stacking these guys because the average cost goes down as Stephenson is undervalued relative to the other two guys who are the snipers who get the high leverage minutes and most of the scoring opportunities when this team was on its attack. The second line, nothing to sleep on. They've been intact since almost the inception of this franchise. Marchessault, Carlson, and Riley Smith, who has had a nice playoff run. This team is primed because of their top six to be a factor anytime they hit the ice. Because of that six-pack up front, they could put them up against any group in the league, including Colorado's top six forwards, from my investment in DFS play. Matthias Janmark, there'll be a key loss there. William Carrier likely moves up into the third-line role on the wing. And then after that, you look at Nicholas Roy and Alex Tuch. Alex Tuch is a real nice wild card for the Knights to have. He comes up and chips in with a lot more offense than you see from other third-line wingers around the league. So great value among their top nine skaters, and not a whole lot in reserve after that. The Avalanche, for their part, we know all about their top line. I've said it on another show. If you call the Bruins top line the perfection line, they got to come up with a similarly euphoric name for McKinnon, Rantanen, and Landeskog. And you said it best, boy. Wouldn't it be fun to watch those two lines go head-to-head in a Stanley Cup final? But I don't think any team has an answer for this trio either. And behind them, they're going to miss Nazem Kadri on the second line. And I'm surprised that they plugged in JT Compher as a second-line center here, AJ, ahead of Tyson Yost. It just shows you that he's continuing to spin his wheels in terms of qualifying for a larger role here. And a similar story on the wings when you consider Valery Nichushkin ahead of Yunus Donskoy on the right side, and Brendan Saad ahead of Andrei Burakovsky. I think we might want to flip those on our RotoWire depth charts going forward, but I'll leave that to you and your breakdown of the forwards too at this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think everything you point out there is pretty accurate. I don't have a ton to add. You know, the depth certainly drops off a little bit for Colorado, but I do like Brendan Saad on that second line. And to your point, you know, Compher filling in right now. Tyson Yost has gotten opportunities there. He hasn't been unproductive in the postseason. You're looking at 3 points in five games, 9 shots on goal, 6 hits. I mean, it's not a terrible performance by him. They certainly will miss Nazem Kadri. There's no doubt about it. He just bolsters the overall depth here. They've got a couple of really unheralded youngsters in Alex Newhook and Sampo Ranta playing on that fourth pairing as a result. But they've got a veteran guy like Carl Soderberg available if they want to use him. And so I like Colorado's depth here. Vegas, as you said, they are facing some serious question marks right now. If Matthias Janmark is going to miss any significant amount of time, they won't have Ryan Reeves for the next two. Thomas Nosek has already been out for a while now. So that's going to really hurt, and they're going to probably just have to rely that much more on the top six. It seems like one man in, one man out. They, as you mentioned, they got Pacioretty back, which is huge for them. He's performed well, a goal and an assist in the first two games back, and I expect him to continue to highlight that top line for them, but they have some serious questions to face here heading into, you know, game two.
AJ, this I'll call this the mini Stanley Cup final because it's the top two teams in the regular season facing off. Again, a shame that it's so early in the postseason. But in terms of the call on the set, I looked at the impact of that first round to make this call, AJ, and I think Colorado's got this series. I think they're taking it in 6 games, and a large price was paid in that first game to give them more. I think it's more than a one-game advantage early on because of the impact of the injury and suspension, but I don't count Vegas out because they are definitely a quality team, and they'll be heard from before the series is out. I do take the Avs in 6, though.
Well, I say this assuming that Marc-Andre Fleury will skate out and lead the team onto the ice for game two. If he doesn't, then I'm switching to Colorado in 4. But as long as Fleury's playing in game two, I do still give the edge to Colorado, but I expect it to take 7 games for them to close this one out. I think it'll be a longer run out. But yeah, if Robin Leonard leaves the team out on the ice for game two, Colorado and four in another sweep, because that was just such a bad performance.
Yikes. All right, then we go to more Sun City locales for the next series, and it's Tampa versus Carolina. The regular season set was tied at four games each, but I think this is one where we disagree a little bit, and I'm looking forward to getting into it. What's the goalie matchup looking like to you, partner?
Well, for their part, the Lightning, no question about it. Andrei Vasilevskiy, another nominee for the Vezina Trophy. And we should mention Marc-Andre Fleury was the third nominee for that award. So we've still got all three of those guys are still playing in the postseason. So Vasilevskiy will obviously lead the way. On the other side, you know, it looks like it'll be Nedeljkovic taking game two tonight. After there were some people saying that his last game wasn't great, but he only gave up two goals on 30 shots. It was a 9.33 save percentage. Like, he played fine in game two, in my opinion. So I don't really know what the concern is there. That last game against Nashville was his only save percentage under .900 in the postseason, but they still managed to close out the series and get the win. So I don't know how you move away from Nedeljkovic at this point. So I think it's pretty clear we'll see him. I think he would have to put out some really bad outings for an extended period of time. Cause you look, he gave up five in game three against Nashville. He gave up four in game four against Nashville, and then he still was the starter for the rest of the way. So I think at this point he's earned the rope here to continue to skate out there and lead the way for them.
Yeah, I think it's a great call. At least they have a very solid secondary option in Peter Mrazek, who was their number one guy much of the season, AJ. But and against almost any other team, you might say give the edge in Carolina's favor, but not when Vasilevsky's at the other end of the ice. He's clearly a cut above either one of these guys, maybe both of them, together even. So that's how good he's been all season and into the postseason. On the defense, again, we're looking at some star power on both sides. Dougie Hamilton is a guy that we all know about as a centerpiece for the back end here. But the don't sell the other three guys in this top four short at all. Jacob Slavin and Brett Pesce, both these guys should be getting a lot more ink than they have received. Brady Shea has taken a bit of a backward step in terms of his offensive production this year, but it's still pretty good, nice-looking quartet there at the top of their rankings on the defensive side of the puck, and all four of them could easily factor into DFS play and good value plays if you're interested in stacking the Hurricanes in any games going forward. Jake Bean and Yanni Hakanpää, much is expected of Jake Bean as he develops in his career, but it's a little early for him to be a primetime player. That's why he's relegated to third-pairing duties. But another guy that, if you're in a dynasty league, this is a guy that I think you should consider stashing, because I think he's going to be a top part of this team going forward. They do still have my old buddy Jake Gardner on the list. I got to mention him before you do, AJ. But a nice-looking defense here, all told, on the Carolina side. On Tampa's side of the ledger, look at Victor Hedman. He's odds-on favorite to win the Norris Trophy again, in my estimation. He's partnered with Jani Ruta now because David Savard is dealing with a bit of an injury situation, so that's a bit of an upset to the top pairing that you might be concerned about. Ryan McDonough, defense-first pairing on the second group with Eric Cernak, but don't sell Cernak short. He's pretty productive offensively in fits and starts this year. And the same can be said for Mikhail Sergachev and in his third pairing role with Luke Shen, a guy who's revitalized his career ever since he arrived in Tampa late last season. Sergachev, a sneaky good DFS value play. He'll get some time on a second power play unit as well to enhance his overall value. How do you break down the defenses? Anything that I missed, partner?
Well, I think you could break down the defenses exactly the same without changing much. You've got one star player who produces a ton offensively, gets a lot of power play minutes and opportunities. A couple of other guys who can contribute offensively that maybe are a little underwhelmed. And then some depth shutdown defenders to round it out. I mean, that's basically the same description for both teams in Dougie Hamilton and Victor Hedman. You know, if you want to be picky, Victor Hedman, no goals yet, nine helpers, eight of those coming on the power play. So The 5-on-5 numbers aren't great there, but who cares, right? If the puck's in the back of the net, the puck's in the back of the net. I think that's all that matters. So overall, I don't see a lot of huge differences defensively in this club. Where the differences for me come are in the forward combinations. Now, things are a little bit shuffled around because Nino Niederreiter is out and dealing with an injury. So you'll get Brock McGinn on the first line with Sebastian Aho and Tuukka Teravainen as they kind of stretch their line combinations here. Then you've got Jordan Martinook, Vincent Trocheck, and Martin Nekash on the third one, or the second one, rather. And then Andrei Svechnikov, Jordan Staal, and Warren Fogle making out your third group. But obviously, Jasper Fast could be a factor in there as well. And look, if they need a goal, they simply move Svechnikov up to Aho and Teravainen's line and stack those guys together. So they have some flexibility and the ability, you know, to move things around. In Tampa, it's somewhat similar. They're a little bit more top six heavy. And in my opinion, you've got Palat, Point, and Kucherov, Stamkos, Cirelli, and Killorn as your one and two lines. And in the third line, I definitely give the edge to Carolina because how they've stretched it out. Barclay Goodrow, Yanni Gourde, and Blake Coleman, not exactly the same trio there. So it's a slight edge for me for Carolina in these combinations. If you're picking the one star player from all of that, obviously Nikita Kucherov has come back and having a fantastic way. Postseason in his return and really leading the way there.
And that's helped revitalize Braden Point. He was struggling offensively for part of the latter part of the season, AJ, but in top form right now, and that makes Andre Palat a sneaky good DFS value play if you want to stack that line. Similar story for the second unit. The star power is Steven Stamkos, and Anthony Cirelli is a guy who's elevated his profile. He's like Chandler Stephenson over in Vegas, AJ. Lucky to be placed in a top six role and growing into that role with the stats showing that growth as well. Alex Killorn, another in a sneaky good value play. They interchange these guys in the top six. So keep an eye on who they're with before you stack those units. The third line for Tampa is better on the ice than it is on paper and in DFS value play. I'll say that, AJ. They're as pesky a unit as you can find outside of the Islanders' fourth line that we highlighted earlier. Yanni Gourde between Blake Coleman and Barclay Goodrow will make opposing forwards keep their heads up, and they'll chip in the odd goal too. But really, I like your call on the Carolina third line. Andrei Svechnikov has played top 6 minutes for this team all year and now switched to a third line role to afford Martinook that promotion on the left side and give more balance and depth to that third unit, which shows Jordan Staal off and running with a nice playoff run, Warren Fogle right alongside him. So giving them a bit of a deeper look than they otherwise had during the regular season, and they need all the depth they can get to fend off the Bolts, which brings us to our call in this series. AJ, I'll go first and say that I think the defending cup champions are just warming up. And they took a home ice advantage away from Carolina in the first game. The second game is a real critical one for the home side. I don't think they're going to blow it and they're going to extend the series, but I do think Tampa's going to come out on top in a 6-game set.
Well, I've been picking Carolina across multiple media appearances and platforms throughout the playoffs, and that game one performance didn't really change that for me. I think they'll come out ahead. I think it'll be a close one. Game one won't be the only one goal contest we see in this series, rather. But I do have Carolina pulling it off in game seven at home.
And that brings us to our last series. I'm going to try and get through this without breaking down, AJ. It's that difficult today. Winnipeg Jets facing the Montreal Canadiens. The regular season series went to the Jets by a total of 6-3. The goalie matchup is a marquee one for sure, AJ. And I know you've got lots to say about both of these guys.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, you know, maybe... Well, no, I mean, Colorado Vegas, they've got a pair of Vezina Trophy finalists this year facing off against each other. So that's probably the best matchup of netminders. But this is certainly right there. And Connor Hellebuyck, who won the Vezina Trophy last year, Carey Price, who is, you know, widely regarded as one of the best netminders in the league, despite what Paul will have you believe if you listen to this podcast. Carey Price, Connor Hellebuyck, both guys capable of stealing a game here, you know, from time to time. honestly, we saw Connor Hellebuyck steal four games, if I'm being totally honest, in the opening series. So this will be a goalie matchup and a goalie battle to watch. Whether either guy can cave, I think will be something to monitor. And if Hellebuyck slips up at all, he's not going to get a lot of cushion, I don't think, because Carey Price is not going to give him a lot of leeway on that one.
You know, what's interesting for me is both of these guys were in the struggling category late in the regular season, AJ, because Hellebuyck was in a downright slump as the season wound down. And then he reels off four straight wins against that two-headed monster in Edmonton that was effectively silenced over a quick set. And meanwhile, Carey Price didn't play for a month before he came back, and with only, I think, half a game in the AHL before he played game one of that seven-game series against the Leafs and stood on his head in long stretches of it. So kudos for both of those guys through the first round. You wonder if one of them will crack and be the difference. That'll be the difference in this series, because I think that it's going to be a lot closer than a lot of other people think looking in. And why don't you tell us about the way the defenses line up for each of these groups? I think they're kind of built similarly almost.
Yeah, I mean, I might give a little bit of edge to Montreal in terms of the offensive firepower that they can put out there. I mean, they do obviously still have Shea Weber. His numbers maybe haven't been quite what they were in years past. And the postseason, it's been nothing. I mean, so let's start there. But I think he's still capable of producing. Jeff Petrie, for his part, too. I mean, one assist in seven games so far, would obviously they would want more out of that, but he's certainly capable of producing. On the other side, you know, for Winnipeg, names that maybe aren't as heard outside of, you know, Western Canada there, but Josh Morrissey and Neil Pionk are certainly capable offensive producers and have done so. Morrissey 4 points in the four games, Pionk with three. Both those guys will see power play minutes. There's questions for me about this third pairing for Winnipeg and Tucker Poolman and Logan Stanley. I'm just not sure about their experience and whether they can hold up there. For Montreal's part, you know, you've got Weber and Petrie give you two separate units. Ben Sherratt, Joel Edmondson are both shutdown defenders who pair well with an offensive guy there. And then it depends on who's available, what they want to do in that third group. We've seen a couple of different combinations there. Eric Gustafsson, Alexander Romanoff, Brett Kulak, even John Merrill, if healthy. I think Montreal, you're looking at it, you've got guys that can be offensive producers but haven't. In Winnipeg, you've got some guys that maybe aren't as widely known as being offensive producers, but have done so. And so I think it's a good kind of combination and an evenly matched set of guys, I think, overall.
Well, and I'm wondering, maybe I'll speak out of turn here, but I'm wondering why the Canadians haven't played Alexander Romanoff in the playoffs yet, AJ. He had a decent rookie season, started off well, but kind of flagged at the end a little bit, but has an offensive upside to his game that I think the bottom pairing certainly doesn't have anything in that regard. And they were used very sparingly, and it really took a toll on guys like that you highlighted that have the DFS value in Montreal, and that's Weber and Petrie. They were worn out in that seven-game set with the Leafs. You could see at the end they had nothing to give offensively and totally focused on the defensive side of the puck. And Petrie, in fact, had what could have been a nightmarish end to his season if the Leafs would have pulled off game six, because he wound up deflecting two of the Leaf goals in that game into his own net in that one. So a bit of a nightmarish night in game six for him, but overall has to be happy that he's in the next round and a chance to rewrite his narrative as of one of the top offensive defensemen as he was in the regular season. For the Jets, you mentioned the two guys, Pionk and Morrissey, have the offensive upside back there. The rest of the guys are big physical players in the mold of the same physical players on the Montreal side. I'm going to give a slight edge to the Jets on the back end, just because I think that Pionk and Morrissey are going to be a little bit healthier going into this round as the offensive pieces rather than their older, skilled counterparts in Montreal. The forward breakdown here for me is an interesting one because the top six forwards in Winnipeg look very eerily similar to the top six that least trotted out in game one with a healthy John Tavares. Mark Scheifele and Paul Stastny holding down the center roles between four wingers that can be really good choices on DFS play every night. And that's Blake Wheeler and Nikolai Ehlers, Kyle Connor and Pierre-Luc Dubois. Don't sleep on third liners in Winnipeg like Andrew Kopp and Mason Appelman. They are regular contributors to the offense, and you can add center Adam Lowry to the mix. So I like the top three forwards here, and they have a rugged fourth line that's going to wear out anybody that Montreal throws out because these guys like to play it physical. And I'm talking about Trevor Lewis, Nate Thompson, and Matthew Perreault. But when we look over at the Montreal side, I'll begin with the fourth line. Their veteran pairing of Eric Staal and Corey Perry had a very nice series against the Maple Leafs and played a very key role in that outcome ultimately. Yoel Armia also a factor there. So they get scoring from up and down the roster. And Jesperi Kotkaniemi is a name that I have to mention as well. Is that he had a very nice series against the Maple Leafs after sitting out the first game. Had an overtime goal, a couple other goals. He was mucking around in the dirty areas, and I love seeing players that step up their game in that regard. So he really got a key, got through a baptism of fire in the Leafs series with flying colors, I'll say. Paul Byron and Josh Anderson, they were up and down for me. Josh Anderson had an outstanding game one, but then went MIA the rest of the series, and he needs to up his game to play it physically like he can. And when he's at the top of that level, he's a scary dude to face because he has the offensive side that goes with it. And then it brings us to the top six. Cole Caulfield, AJ, this guy looked like a raw rookie in this series. One highlight for him was the overtime, the 2-on-0 breakaway goal that he helped engineer. But otherwise, for me, it was very hard to find many highlights of him. A couple of shots that were high and off the post or whatever were other highlights. But other than that, I didn't see much from him and would like to see more growth. He's a kid, though, and getting his first start. Maybe we'll see more. But I think Canadian fans can look forward to a strong partnership for him because I know he has the skills. There's no doubting that. It's just the experience that he needs. And that partnership that he has with Nick Suzuki will only flourish even more in that regard. And the beneficiary is their left wing, Tyler Toffoli, who had a struggle to start this postseason but finished strong. And then the top line that deserves full marks, Philip Deneau, Brendan Gallagher and Jake Evans, they really showed up in the latter part of that first series, and they're going to drive somebody crazy that they get in the first-round matchup, whether it be the first or second line, I'm not sure, but they're going to be a handful, and they're going to limit whatever line that is to the best of their ability.
Well, Paul, I'm just wondering how that crow tasted from having to give credit to Jesperi Kotkaniemi on top of watching your team lose.
I'm shaking my head as I say it.
But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, he led the team in goals with three of them, so certainly producing well there. Look, I came into this expecting to give a heavy favorite to Winnipeg, but Paul, I think you sold me a little bit more on the Montreal forwards here. The biggest concern is the potential absence of Thomas Tatar and Arturi Lehkonen. If those guys are out for any extended run of time beyond what they've already missed, I think the depth losses there, especially on the left-hand side, will start to add up. So they need to get those guys back and healthy sooner rather than later. But overall, I think I still favor Winnipeg in this one in terms of the forward complements. I love that top six. I really think they've finally kind of figured it out. How best to utilize those guys for now and to get the most out of them moving forward.
Which brings us to our series picks, and my mini Stanley Cup is awarded to whichever team Montreal gets eliminated by every year, and I'm awarding that to the Winnipeg Jets this season in anticipation of a six-game victory in this series against Les Habitants. What's your call?
Well, I'm going to take the Jets in five. I know a bit of a risky call. Montreal ground one out. I talked at length about Carey Price there, but I like the forwards better. The defense, as you said, for Montreal isn't really producing right now, so you give him the edge there. And then Hellebuyck was just outstanding in that first series, and he's not going to face anything like the level of talent he had to face in that first series. And so I expect the Jets to make Some quick work here of Montreal, which I know will do you some good, Paul.
Yeah, and the fact we didn't mention the Winnipeg Jets came in rested from this into this matchup, where the Canadiens did go seven games. So maybe the first game gets punted just the same way as we saw Vegas and Colorado. But AJ, we are going to send this out very soon, and the next time you hear us will be in anticipation of the third round matchups. We thank all our listeners for being loyal to us all year long and for the questions you've sent us, and we'll wrap up this episode of the podcast by urging you to remember and send your comments or questions on Twitter. Follow me, Paul Bruno, at Statsman22. You can follow AJ at AJSchultz24. As always, we invite you to listen in to Puckcast, RotoWire's signature fantasy podcast, to get our tips to stay out of the competition in your fantasy hockey planning and research. So long, everybody.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.